Session number 13265, reel number 13.
Mr. Marsden, reel 13. Mm-hmm. You've been issued with?
Yes, we've been issued with a Lee Enfield rifle and a couple of clips. And as I say, I can't remember exactly when and where and when and why, but it may well have been at the time at Tangmere of the invasion scare before we got the Canadian rifles. Anyway, I still had these five rounds in the bottom of my kit bag, and that of course was illegal, and so I was charged with having illegal possession of five rounds of service ammunition as well. So I can't remember whether I was taken before the station CO as it were unofficially rather than on in terms of a full blown charge. I forget the exact wording of the charge with relation to the photography, but I'm sure somebody in legal minds can find it. But I think the squadron engineer officer had already had a word with Groupie, the station CO, and I think I have an idea that by this time it wasn't Ive Lord Chapman. I've got a feeling it might have been Whitley. Anyway, he was, whoever it was, it wasn't Ive Lord Chapman, and he was a reasonable chap, and he wanted to know all about it. And I said, well, it's quite simple. I said, I'm just a keen aeroplane nut. I said, I've been keen on aeroplanes all my life. I'm an aero modeller. I build model aeroplanes. I collect photographs of aeroplanes. I'm keen on aircraft identification. I said, it's, I said, you're in the Air Force. You, that's why you're here, I suppose. You, that's what it's all about. Ah. And he says, and do you have an album at home? I said, oh, yes. I said, I've got, you know, I've got all sorts of stuff in it. I've got photographs, a set of photographs of B.C. Hooks and the first aeroplane to visit Chesterfield, the Blériot. Oh, yes. Oh, and so on and so on, you see. Well, I said, I'd like to see that. He said that the first thing you'd do better do then, he says, you'd better go home and collect that album, he says, and bring it back to show me. So I got a 48-hour pass. Whilst I'm on a charge, I got a 48-hour pass to go home and get my album, which is by no means common, you know. You don't usually get that 48-hour pass when you're on a fizzer in the service. So I toddled off home and I got the album and showed him. And some of the photographs I'd been given by a bud who'd been in the RAF in India before the war, and he was quite interested in those because I think he'd been out there. Oh, I remember those, yes, and so on, you know, that kind of thing. So he accepted that I was taking photographs of aeroplanes because I liked aeroplanes, fair dues. And as it turned out, because I had not included any buildings or airfield structures which were identifiable, and only shown aeroplanes, and not always particularly close up, the station master was quite happy to say, well, fair enough, there's nothing there really, that, he says, whilst technically it's illegal, he says, there's nothing there you've done that's going to cause us any grief in terms of security. Case dismissed. But for the five rounds ammunition, 14 days jankers. 14 days confined to camp.
You should have handed it in.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it should have been handed in. But one of the most difficult things in the Air Force, if you're ever issued with a rifle and ammunition, one of the most difficult things you ever come across, especially if the squadron or the unit moves or you move, is to get rid of it. It's the very devil to try to get rid of a rifle once one's been signed out to you. I was issued with one when I was in second TAF in 44, and I don't think I got rid of it. That would be in April, May of 44. I didn't get rid of that rifle until, I think, probably November of that year in St. Athan. Or it might even have been when I eventually got to Henlow. But certainly it took some months, because from first trying to get rid of it on a station where I did get rid of it, I can remember that it took at least a couple of months before I could persuade them to sign it on, because of course they hadn't had it on strength, and it paperwork, oh dear, you know. And it's not like a hangar, you can't an aircraft hangar, you know. I mean, it's quite easily done with paperwork. You can write that off from being an aircraft hangar to from a hangar's aircraft to hangar's coat, and then you can soon get rid of it. But a rifle, that's a different proposition. Anyway, so I'm on 14 days jankers, and I'm no sooner on jankers than up on, I don't know if it was on DROs, yes, it would be on daily routine orders, notification of LAC Marsden promoted corporal. So the CO sends for me, not the station CO, our own CO, sends for me, and points out gently that I can't really put my tapes up whilst I'm on jankers serving 14 days for a crime. I have to wait until after. So at the end of my 14 days, I'm a corporal. Which a few buds found quite amusing. I can't say that I was that amused. It cost me 14 days pay as a corporal, that did. The difference. We toddle along from there. And would you like... I could stop.
Yeah.
Came up... it was decided to do a daylight raid on La Police. I think it was Gneisenau was in La Police. Scharnhorst and Gneisenau were lying up in Brest and La Police at this time. And they had been bombed at night by the squadron, and of course by the RAF anyway. But it was, I suppose, known that they were preparing to get them out and shift them so that they could get them operational again for a breakout. And it was decided to have a go in daylight. And I think our squadron and 76 squadron with Halifaxes, and I think one or two other squadrons with Wellingtons were put onto this job. And our kites took a bit of a dusting. We lost several. And I think one got back to Linton-on-Ouse. I'm trying to remember... I'd have to look in my own paperwork to find it, but I'm trying to remember how many got struggled back to St. Evel. Anyway, they got back to St. Evel and they were all unserviceable. And a party of us were sent down to St. Evel, down in Cornwall, by road. A couple of trucks, a couple of Merlin engines in the trucks with the big jacks that we used for jacking the aircraft up. Couple of spare wheels, all our tools and other spares necessary for the job. We belted off from Linton. We got down to Cheltenham somewhere about 10 o'clock at night and were put up in the church hall. And then an early breakfast the following morning and off away down to Cornwall. The drive down to Cheltenham that night was hair-raising. Both drivers had their had full plug on, and the headlights in those days, of course, were abysmal, with only those slits in the covers. No lighting, no street lighting anywhere, and there were no motorways yet. The roads, the A roads, by today's standards, were practically B roads today. So it was distinctly hairier, and if you were riding in the back of one of those trucks, big Dodgers, with all this heavy stuff in there, shifting about on the corners and so on, it was exciting to say the least, and downright uncomfortable as well. Anyway, we got to St. Evel, I think about 1 o'clock the following day, which was probably not bad driving for those days, from York. And we were given a billet, a hut to put our kit into, and we went to find our aeroplanes, and they were a very sad sight. One of them had had the rear gunner killed in it. I knew him. It was a blonde lad, quite a nice lad. And the day of the raid, the day of the operation, was his 21st birthday. And his 21st birthday present was an explosive 20mm cannon shell in the face, which blew his head off and spattered his brains round the inside of the turret. And the turret had been roughly hosed out by the time we got down there, but it was still a bit grotty. Another cannon shell on the same aircraft, another cannon shell had hit the elevator main spar, not the tailplane main spar, but the elevator main spar, which was a tubular spar 4 or 5 inches in diameter, tubular metal spar. The shell had hit that and exploded. I counted 127 holes coming out. There's the 20mm hole going in at the one side and 127 holes in the area coming out t'other. And the kite had been flown back from La Police with the elevator in that state. That was in the middle between the elevator halves in the turret area. And the when one walked along the fuselage back, it looked as though somebody had walked along the fuselage with an escape axe, an RAF escape axe in each hand, slashing the back of the fuselage, as one, you know, as though somebody had done it walking along and taking a couple of slashes with every stride. A tremendous amount of metal damage there. And of course there were fuel tanks had been holed. But by this time, our aircraft had self-sealing tanks, which had caused a bit of a problem at the time, because we'd had to drop the original unsealed tanks out and push the new tanks in. And since the tankage capacity had been kept the same, the extra dimensions on the tank resulting from wrapping with kind of latex sponge rubber material to produce the self-sealing wrap. This meant that the tanks were considerably bigger in width, length, depth, all three dimensions, and had to be literally pushed into place. And it had been quite a job on the squadron to replace all those tanks. Anyway, they'd been perforated by machine gun rounds, fortunately not my cannon rounds, otherwise the kite would have gone up. And so they stood there with fuel dripping, just gently dripping. The self-sealing tanks didn't make a totally complete seal, safe seal. They did tend to drip if there was any amount of fuel in the tank, but at least it didn't run. So we had the job of doing, I think, 2 engine changes, I can't remember whether it was one or two wheel changes, and we had to do a little bit of patching, very often mostly in the form of like on that turret, fabric just patched over the hole just to stop drafts whistling through the aeroplane. And we spent something like about a week, I suppose, down at St. Avil working on these aircraft. I was a bit unhappy by this time, because after that first time out of the hut, when from the time we got there, and I'd left my kit bag in there, we went to the aircraft and got a meal and did some work. When I got back, my kit bag had been opened and my camera had been stolen. I'd recently got rid of my Zeiss baby box. I think possibly because it wasn't too easy to get the size film for the Zeiss, for the baby box. I think that was a 116, 127 film or something small. Film was very scarce and short in wartime anyway, and you had to have an in with someone to get any, but the 120 size was easier. And so I bought myself £3.12 and sixpence, a lot of pennies in those days, a week's wages for a tradesman. I bought myself a Kodak folding camera, 3x2.5, 120 size, the bellows type thing, but with focusing on the lens rather than with the sliding shoe, which was the older, slightly older style. And a very nice leather case, extra 7 and sixpence. It's like paying £200 for a camera, isn't it? You know, today, or rather more, a week's wages. And that had been stolen. Well, whilst I reported it to the guardroom, I doubt if they were sympathetic. They might even have been involved in nicking it, I don't know. But of course, it was illegally on the station. It hadn't been registered and so on. I wasn't going to use it because I had no film, but it was tucked in the kit bag. It had to be somewhere. And so I was very disgruntled about the whole thing. So about a week's work, and we got these ready, and we signed for them on the Form 700s as unserviceable, fit to fly, which I think is probably a fairly rare occurrence in the service. And one or two of us offered, I don't know whether there were, I still can't remember whether there were three Halifaxes or four, or whatever, three or four or five. Anyway, we signed for them, as I say, US fit to fly, and we offered to fly back with them as flight engineers, as much as anything to avoid going back in a truck, you know. But we were refused permission to fly in them, and they were flown back by pilots flying solo without flight engineer at all, simply because of the nature of the beast. I mean, the one with the damaged elevator spar, it was a distinctly dicey do, although it flew back to Linton and it was quite happily, but if it had run into any bad turbulence and so on, it could quite easily have lost half an elevator, or possibly both. I'm not sure about the where that damage was in relation to the horn, the main horn which drives the elevator in the Halifax. So as it turned out, we didn't do too badly, because we were flown back in a Sparrow, and we had quite a nice flight up the Bristol Channel and across country and across over Doncaster once again. And this time I was able to recognise where I was as we flew over Derbyshire. We didn't get over Chesterfield quite, but I knew where I was. And so home. When we got back, the one with the damaged turret and the goo in it, they didn't even attempt to repair the turret. The turret was taken out, new turret fitted, and the airframe underneath the turret was, you know, before the new turret went in, was scrubbed and cleaned as far as it could possibly be done to avoid smell. And the old turret was taken out and was nominally to be used for training purposes. It was set up on a stand, so that in fact, without perspex, so that it could be operated, but it never was. No, it was just put on a stand out in the weather and just left to rot. You know, I suppose it really should have been sent back to manufacturer, stripped down, and the bits used elsewhere would have been a better thing to do. But I think it was almost regarded as being like a tombstone monument to the lad who bought it. And when I left Linton on Ouse, it was still sitting there out in the weather. I think Revs Rivas, who was the squadron gunnery officer, I think by this time, I think he was in one of the kites which was shot down, and they went for a short swim and became members of the Goldfish Club. You know about that, don't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We had a rather funny little incident about this time. One of the Whitleys of 58 Squadron came back, and he came back and he hadn't got rid of his bombs. I don't know if he thought he had, but he hadn't. And I think he made an approach and found out that he was a bit heavy or something, so he hauled off again and went round. And somebody aboard discovered that they hadn't got rid of the bombs and pressed the tits. And set the whole station in an uproar as this great stick of bombs came crunching and exploded just off station. And a few nights later, one of them came back, struggled back, and I don't know whether it was, you know, one of those North Country night ground mists or what it was, but he missed the station. It might have been that famous night when Bomber Command lost 62 aircraft in crashes on landing on return from operations. They lost practically no aircraft on operations, and lost about 3 squadrons full of kites in landing crashes, trying to land in fog when they got back, in ground mist. I know there were 16 wrecks of various kinds of aeroplanes round Linton-on-Ouse that morning, tails stuck up in the air in all directions. There was a Whitley had crashed into the hangar doors, that was stuck up with the wings at about 45 degree angle and the tail in the air. And I think the air gunner, the tail gunner, I think he broke his ankle jumping out of the aeroplane. Anyway, one kite went down into the River Ouse, which was not very far away. Now, the aircraft were just about spanned the river at that point, and they could have, I think they could have walked out along the fuselage and jumped down off the tail end, jumped off the tailplane onto the bank. But the pilot decided that they were going to get to be members of the Goldfish Club, so they blew the dinghy and got the dinghy out and paddled ashore and qualified. On the morning after that bad mist, when there were so many crashes around, one of our chaps in the squadron, wandering around these aircraft, said to somebody, "Ooh, what's this on the leading edge of this aircraft?" I think it was probably a Wimpy. And he stuck his finger in it, it went bang and cut his finger off. It was a balloon cable cutter, which I think we'd not had fitted up to that time. We got them later, but I don't think he'd seen one before, and he stuck his finger in it to find out what it was, and it told him. The cable cutters were a kind of solid steel short G cramp fitted onto the leading edge, so that as a cable slid along the leading edge, it would slide in and push a cutter which was 5/8 of an inch in diameter with a chisel end on it, and it was fired by a cartridge, and pressure in there triggered it off, released it, and the thing simply slammed and would chop a steel cable through. And they were fitted on aircraft, one at the wing root by the fuselage, where the cable might run to and stop, one at the wing root by the engine nacelle, and then another one at the other side of the nacelle, and so on, along the leading edge, so that wherever the cable might run, it would eventually run into one of these devices and trigger it off. At about this time, too, we'd sealed the Handley Page slats, which were fitted to Halifaxes, because pilots found that with the slats open to produce slots, leading edge slots, you know about these things?
No.
Ah. Leading edge slots are an aerodynamic device. They can be built in as part of the wing, so that you get behind the leading edge of the wing on some smaller aircraft, you get a slot going through the wing which follows the general profile of the leading edge of the upper leading nose of the airfoil section, and that slot at high angles of attack produces the slot and the slat combined have the effect of producing a deflected airflow which is held over the surface of the wing, so that the wing can reach a higher angle of attack before stalling, before the airflow breaks away. In effect, it's rather like those little tea trays that you see fitted on the back of saloon cars to convince the driver that it's capable of going fast today. That works the other way on to provide a download on the back wheels. Similar kind of thing. In fact, I guess the folks who patented the Handley Page slat and slot ought to be able to claim from the motor manufacturers on the strength of it. Well, as I say, with those open, they on the Halifax and the Hampton and so on, these things are part of the leading edge but separated from it, so that when the wing comes to a higher angle of attack and the airflow alters and the pressure above the leading edge is reduced, then these things fly open, and so you then have a slat in front of the leading edge of the wing and the appropriate slot. When they open on a Halifax, it would float forever, especially if there was a nice breeze and it was headed into it, it would float forever across the field. Instead of being able to land and put it down, the other thing is wanting to fly, you see. Which means that for unsuspecting pilots who are not clued up and so on, and who don't slam the tail down and really get it down and so on, they find themselves overrunning and in danger of going into the hedge at the far side. So the suggestion of the experienced pilots, they'd all been fastened shut. Handley Page had a lot of experience with these. On the Hampton, the 83 Squadron pilots had these things weighed off to such an extent that they could bring a Hampton down at a steep angle on full flap, and with the engine running, they could bring them down very steeply and land with the actual roll 150 yards or so. At the last minute, just before touchdown, from this angle, the nose was brought down and the engines throttled back and straightened.